and by a sense that while community involvement is pretty rich and pretty vibrant in all kinds of neighborhoods around our city, political participation, voter turnout, showing up to speak your mind to city council, for example, that all of those things have really declined, and that many Austinites are simply out of the habit of making their voices heard, particularly in the political realm. So there was an optimism, but a cautious, tempered optimism. The second theme that really rose was the sense that Austin may be far from being the one Austin that Leadership Austin and others, everyone in this room, likes to talk about, likes to idealize. That there's tremendous variation across these newly formed districts in terms of their experiences, their sense of identification with the larger city, the levels of engagement and paying attention to affairs and being involved in public affairs, tremendous variation across the different districts. And a real question arises about how can we create a sense that Austin really is one city now divided into 10 districts that each themselves have some kind of shared identity. And then the third theme was clearly people think that this is a moment of opportunity and that the moment is now to seize it. And this, in fact, fits with a little bit of academic research that has been done on these kinds of transitions, these kinds of changes in electoral systems, that the research suggests that they do create a moment of opportunity, but then voter turnout, for example, quite often will level out to pretty much the levels it was before. So that suggests that other things have to be done. The transition to 10-1, most people we interviewed thought that that was terrific because it can create a closer relationship between representatives and their constituencies. But there's going to probably be more than that needed, that people need other ways of making themselves heard and hearing from city government. And that was one of the biggest takeaways. People across the city voiced the desire for new, different, better, more meaningful, more convenient ways to make their voices heard. So I think that sets a nice context for our discussion this morning. And absolutely, just thanks again for the opportunity.
Thank you for this amazing research.
Let's start with the questions. First, for the mayor, cautiously optimistic is how this new report describes folks' view of the switch to 10-1 here in Austin. Mayor, and 6 months in, how is the transition going, and where are the smooth spots, and where are the bumps in the road?
5 months in, but who's counting? I think it's going really well. You know, there was, as we were going through the process last year in the campaign, a lot of concern that we would have a government that would be unable to act, a government that would be unable to do things, that we would immediately devolve into a ward politics system and that we would be immobilized because of that. And I think that we have seen anything but that. We have seen a council that came together and unanimously changed the structure of government by moving to committees. And that's a real fundamental change in how governance works, and that was done unanimously. I think if you look at what's happening on the dais, you'll see that there are a lot more votes that are happening other than 6-5, and there's no rancor on the council. People are respectful of one another. In fact, I think people like one another. We have spent hundreds of hours as a group doing deep dive, which really aren't deep dive, but policy sessions where we are arguing and discussing policy without making decisions, and I think that's paying off. It'll be interesting to see what happens this week on the homestead exemption, because if there was ever an issue that should shut us down, that would be it. And we'll see what happens tomorrow, but I think this community is going to see yet further evidence of a group of people, very talented council people, and I'm real proud to serve with them, that are really rising to the challenge. I think the optimism and the belief in the community that this is the moment, which was another aspect, that this is the moment, that there's an opportunity here, is not lost on this council. And I am real encouraged, and I think that it's going really well.
And Mayor, I know that we're going to talk about homestead exemption since you guys are voting on that tomorrow, but I want to get to Judge Eckhart, who, first of all, did you bicycle to the breakfast today?
I don't live that far away. It's not that impressive.
I think that's awesome. Way to go, Green City, Green County. Now, I know that you didn't take over a brand new form of government like Mayor Adler did, but this is such a pivotal time in the county's history. So talk about that from a leadership perspective. What have you found to be the highs and lows on the job so far?
There's a tremendous amount of pent-up innovation in Travis County government structure. It's a very stable structure. You know, we're one of 254 counties, but as one county judge says up in Tarrant, if you've seen one county, you've seen one county. People like myself, people who come to work for Travis County government, they get married to the county and they don't leave. They continue innovating inside that structure. I myself am a 14-year veteran of Travis County government, and what you find is you find people sitting around the table who, you know, I'm not that long in the tooth. I started when I was in my 30s. You find a lot of people who started at the county in their 20s as law clerks, as executive secretaries, as low-level budget analysts who are now the chief financial officer, who are now the chief administrator of the criminal courts. So it's there's a tremendous amount of talent there. And so what I've found, actually, is just figuring out how to utilize all of the talent that's bubbling up. There's a lot of people coming out of the woodwork saying, I've had this idea for the longest time to make our government more effective, more efficient, and more affordable. Will you help me implement it? So that's just been an incredible pleasure. I hope that that level of enthusiasm continues. If I can keep harvesting that at a decent rate, people will keep bringing it. If they start to feel disappointed in the pace of change, that's my major concern, is that I won't be able to get to all of the good ideas fast enough to keep everyone bringing them.
Here's a question for both of you. The report we heard about shows folks in the community have a real sense of urgency about the critical issues that we all know about. But many of them, of course, don't feel that they have a voice in local government, and we see this on the national level, too. What are you doing, Mayor, to reach out to people and tell them that you're engaged and you want to solve these problems?
You're asking about civic engagement, getting people involved. This is a council that has put civic engagement on steroids, at least in our process. We started off with that first council meeting in January, where we dealt with the committee structure, and we had calls that went out to 50,000 people in Austin a week before, inviting them to participate. There were 50,000 calls that happened that night, and people were urged to stay on the line. Almost 10,000 people did. People participated in that meeting through their touch tone, voting and reacting to questions that were asked. People were tweeting in and having their comments read live during the discussion, as if those folks were present in the room. We moved to the committee system, which is now bringing people into the process earlier than they would have. People used to show up at council meetings and speak and would leave frustrated because they thought the decision had already been made before they talked, probably because the decision had already been made before they talked. But now they have an opportunity to participate, and they are actively involved in what's happening. And then we have a special task force on civic engagement that is the work of a council member, Poole, who's here and working incredibly hard. And I don't know if there are other council members that are in the room. I just haven't seen them if they're here. But a committee, that task force, that's looking at how to take that to an even higher level. There are council members that have district offices that are open every day of the week, and people who won't drive from those distances to come downtown are now being serviced and by staff out in the districts where they're present. We have more council members doing neighborhood meetings than have ever happened before, and town hall meetings in districts. Again, we're trying to step up to the promise and potential.
What about on the county level?
At the county level, a lot of people talk about how 10-1, they were afraid 10-1 would bring ward politics. Well, I have been in a system of what amounts to ward politics for 14 years. We have four different precincts, and that is set in the Texas Constitution. And I'm here to attest to the fact that when you do have geographic representation, you can and should be able to achieve a sense of doing what's best for the whole while vigorously representing your geographic area. So we have for a long time had commissioners and a mechanism for being out in the community, for having offices out in the community. We have we have community centers in every quadrant of the county. All of our offices are open every day. We meet every single week. We have a public communication that's available to citizens to come, and non-citizens, to come and bring information to us every single Tuesday. Our engagement is high. We have recently, in the last 5 years or so, we have entered this new century with regard to IT and are now developing some of the transparency and web informational portals that the city has long had. And I'm very excited about that, so that folks can, you know, sit in their boxer shorts at 2 a.m. and check out our budget if they want.
That's like way too much information.
Right. But we are developing an open government portal where you can actually slice and dice our budget whenever you feel like through our webpage. If you want to figure out what percentage of our budget goes to criminal justice, and inside that criminal justice line, how much is corrections and how much is jail diversion programs, you will be able to do it very soon. You will be able to take a look and then bring your ideas for how we can do it more effectively, more efficiently, and more affordably. And I'm very excited about that.
We want to get to some of the questions that the folks in the audience have, and we wanted to talk about the homestead exemptions, and that's coming up this week. And this is the question from one of our audience members, and I'll address this to you, Mayor, since this is on your agenda. Is the proposed homestead exemption worth all the services that will have to be cut? I know homestead exemption was a huge issue for many of the candidates running and yourself. So what will have to be sacrificed if we cut our taxes?
You know, there are a couple different ways to do a homestead exemption. One way is to cut services. I've never been in favor of that, and ran last year suggesting that there was a better way to do that. And my hope is that tomorrow the council picks the other way of doing it, which does not involve cutting services. You know, we set a tax rate. There's an effective tax rate, and then we pick the tax rate we're going to set. That tax rate that we set is based on the amount of money that needs to be raised in order to do the budget that we want to do. Now, there's a limit to how far we can raise our tax rate, because we can't go above the rollback rate without opening up for a potential election, which nobody wants to put the community through. So there's a cap on how high, in a practical sense, we would go. But also, the city never goes to that level. There's a place below that level where we have historically gone to. And what I suggested to the council is that we set our budget with all the services and everything that we want to provide, and we figure out where that place is. And then the very last thing we do is we add on top of that a homestead exemption. And we raise the rate in order to pay for that homestead exemption, which means you're not cutting any services. You have the services that set your budget. The very last thing you do is to add the homestead exemption. And you raise the rate in order to make it revenue neutral so that it doesn't cost any services. By doing that, what happens is there is a shift of the tax burden from residential property to commercial property. And quite frankly, I'm fine with that happening in this city, because I think in recent times the balance between the burden paid by commercial property and residential property has gotten out of kilter. Home prices and residence prices are going up 3.5 times faster than income. If your property taxes go up on a commercial property, you can raise your rent or sell more widgets. But if your property taxes go up on your homestead and your incomes haven't gone up the same way, you're out of luck. So I would propose that we set our budget, do all the social services we want to do, cut none of them, and then add the homestead exemption, which will cause only this shift, and it will result in a decrease in the taxes that are paid by the median home, half of which, 50% of which, are valued at less than $227,000 in this city.
Now, while we're talking taxes, let's delve a little bit deeper. First of all, you mentioned commercial property. I know know that this is an area that you might not see eye to eye to with on the county level. There's some issues there, and Judge Eckhart, could you talk about that? Because I know that the county, I mean, the city proposal to cut commercial property taxes hasn't been embraced at the county as much as some would like at City Hall. So tell us about that.
Well, you know, this is a very good dynamic that's working between the city and the county right now, actually. I like to characterize this as a little bit of intergovernmental competition. And when you have a little bit of competition, you see differing points of view. You're more likely to see the full landscape instead of having a, sort of a monopoly in government where you will only have the perspective of one set of leadership. I myself was in favor of the tax challenge. I lost that vote, but my commissioner's court chose not to move forward with the tax challenge on a 3-2 vote. But in the bigger picture, the bigger picture that paints for us between city and county, I think is important. Because Travis County has a homestead exemption and has for a long time, the full exemption of 20%. And what Mayor Adler is saying is absolutely true. When you do a homestead exemption, you do shift the burden off of residential homeowners and onto commercial property owners. And that is appropriate in the state of Texas because we don't have an income tax. And once you make that shift, yes, it creates it affects your budget, but you simply adjust your budget, which Travis County has been doing for years and years. So the city, in some respects, is riding on the county's experienced coattails in regard to homestead exemption. And the county, frankly, is riding the city's coattails on tax challenge. While we didn't vote to join in the tax challenge, it was a very close vote, 3-2, we get all of the benefits if the city wins their challenge. And I want to applaud Mayor Adler and the City Council for bravely moving forward on that tax challenge. It's going to be incredibly useful to all of us. And I also want to thank Senator Watson for pushing so hard to make our homestead exemption a little bit better this session. It didn't pass this time, but he has a wonderful, wonderful piece of legislation that he and Representative Rodriguez have pushed before to create a homestead exemption that has a flat dollar cap so that it is more progressive. People at the lower end of homeownership will get a larger benefit in terms of their pocketbook, in terms of their affordability, than those at the higher end that don't need the exemption for affordability. So this is a good thing. I would have liked my commissioner's court to have joined the city and shown an open partnership, but I understand the fear, and that's something that we have to look at and be honest about, the fear of a tax challenge. And we have to be prepared to mitigate whatever real but unintended consequences come from a tax challenge.
May I add a quick question?
Yes, and also before we continue, could everybody make sure they're speaking closely to the microphone?
Am I not eating the mic enough?
No, yeah, the people in the back tell me, they're texting me, tell me they're having trouble hearing.
Sorry.
Raise your voice, just like 10-1. We raise voices. We want you guys to raise your voice. Go ahead, Mayor.
I just want to touch base just real quickly, because the question was asked in terms of the county juxtaposed to the city. I am really enjoying working with the judge. And we are, see, and we are doing that much more than any of you could possibly imagine. We regularly meet, and we even more regularly talk. Our ability to do the tax challenge passed unanimously at our city council, which is a tribute not only to the concept of ward politics happening at the city level, which I think is remarkable that was a unanimous vote on our council, but it's also a tribute to the strategy. strategy that was employed to get there, the ownership of which is partly due to the strategic work that we were doing together in terms of how to raise that. So I just want to say thank you, and there's a lot more communication going on between city county now than I think has ever occurred before.
Maybe you guys can bike together next year for the engaged breakfast.
There you go.
You know, I walked to work today, but it's even less impressive than...
Well, let's move to another. Everything revolves around money, it seems, in these meetings. But we've been following the story that Austin's losing its reputation of being the live music capital of the world because musicians simply can't afford to live here anymore, and not only musicians, lots of other folks too. What's being done, Mayor, to address the problem?
You know, there is nothing worse than being the city that used to be the cool city. You know, you can identify those cities. I used to say, and I'm about to say again, that you can tell those cities because those are the cities that now have a music museum downtown.
Music museum.
Ooh. I said that a few weeks ago, and this whole group of people from Cleveland that were sitting, and that speech came up to me. And I don't really. But when you talk about the warning signs, they are there. I mean, there are so many wonderful things happening in this city, and we can't let that happen. The affordability issue with respect to our music industry is just evidenced by the report that just came out. Is stark, and it's something that we have to deal with. But it is the same or similar question about affordability in our city generally. I mean, people are being priced out of their homes, and musicians are being priced out of their venues. There are lots of things that we need to be doing to address affordability in this city. I think the homestead exemption is part of that. The drainage fee true-up is real important about that. The drainage fee impact on renters is going to be several times more grand or more material than what we're talking about even in the homestead exemption for property owners. We need to move forward with homestead preservation districts in this city, not only because of the TIF ability that they have. But most cities in the country use an inclusionary zoning tool in order to be able to help drive housing that's affordable. We can't do that in Austin because the legislature passed a bill that took that power away from us, except in areas that have been designated as homestead preservation districts. Why we haven't designated this entire city as a homestead preservation district beyond me. But we're going to start moving to do that in every part of this town that we can, even if we don't TIF it, just so that we have the development and planning tool available to us. We have to fix the permitting and the code process in the city so that supply and demand can reach equilibrium. And the capital expenditure to make sure that that happens following from the Zucker report, I am pretty sure is something that this council is going to deliver on as part of this budget season. And then we need a strike fund. We need, and we can talk later, I hope you ask questions about moving toward social innovation and social entrepreneurship in the city. It's something that we uniquely have in Austin that we need to use. But we should have a strike fund that's buying up and preserving not only Class C and D housing and maintaining it that way, but we should be doing the same thing with music venues. Those are treasures to this city, and there is no live music capital in Austin if we don't preserve the farm system that enables artists to grow and to learn their trade and to be able to earn a life at the same time that they're doing it.
And this really all falls into this growing divide we've been examining during this Engaged Breakfast series. And Judge Eckhart, talk about this from the county level when it comes to this disparity in income, race, and education. What are some tangible solutions, or what are you attacking at the county level to tackle this problem?
Sure. Have any of y'all seen a website called Opportunity Matters Central Texas? Some of you have. Go check it out. It is a very interesting website that was put together several years ago with a lot of different governmental and private sector partners in this community to map opportunity in Central Texas based on educational attainment rate, healthcare outcomes, housing costs, various different metrics of opportunity. And it's an interesting website to go look at, because it paints in stark terms how we have become economically segregated. And it's a fairly hard line of segregation. It's clear that we have a out-migration from the city of Austin to the east, toward affordability, toward Pflugerville, Manor, Bastrop, and to some degree to the south as well, into Hays County. This is a fact that we need to address. And so, just as the mayor mentioned, you know, whether we do a homestead preservation district citywide, whether we utilize tax increment financing or tax reinvestment zones, whether we use land banks in order to preserve affordability in our community, these are all tools that we need to look at together. Because, as I've said before, the city of Austin could do everything exactly right and be incredibly innovative, but without mirroring that effort outside the city, we will have unintended consequences, and we will have a movement out into the county that does not have as many tools as the city has. We will have an out-migration into the county where there aren't as many services, where there's not as good of a transportation network, where the utilities do not have the level of positive regulation and progressive rate structure. So people might move, they might drive until they qualify, only to find that their actual annual expenses are higher than they were inside the city limits because of hidden costs. Hidden costs of taking toll roads every day. Hidden costs of having to pay a separate entity to pick up their trash. Hidden costs of not being able to find the services for their child who happens to be dyslexic or have learning disabilities or, God forbid, have some mental health issues. So these are things that we must partner in, whether it is the city of Austin, the city of Manor, the city of Pflugerville, the city of Lakeway, the community of Manchac. These are things that we really have to look at countywide, even region-wide. We've developed a healthcare district, and I know we've got a representative from Central Health here. Thank you, Cynthia. And we see a lot of free rider from the outlying counties. So we really need to be thinking regionally with regard to this affordability and opportunity. And I would caution, one of my big things to caution about with regard to affordability, don't just think affordability, because then we might cheap out. Think effective, efficient, and affordable. Effective first, efficient, and affordable.
Let me ask you about the possibility. You talk about your relationship with working together with the city and the county. Would there be any concept in going forward, maybe combining the city and county governments? Is that even allowed in the state of Texas, like we have Miami-Dade County in Florida? Is that something that would ever work here?
You know, when I think of all the things on my plate and all the things that this council is trying to deal with, the truth is that I really haven't thought about that. I just really haven't thought about that. And I think that we're going to grow, and regional involvement is ever more important every day, for all the reasons that the judge just described. Over the first time that we've been in office, the poverty rate in the city of Austin has gone down dramatically. But it hasn't gone down because of anything we've done, and it hasn't gone down because there's less poverty. It's gone down in the city of Austin because it's moving out into the county, and that's not something to be proud of. We're doing more and more now in conversations with San Marcos and with Georgetown and with Bastrop, so it even spreads beyond just the city of Austin and Travis County. I was meeting last week with the San Antonio Corps. board or council. When you look at what Central Texas is going to be in 25 years, I'm not sure that it's not San Antonio and Austin that is the combined real operative player in the region. So it's not something, the answer to your question, it's not something that we're moving toward. But quite frankly, I'm not sure if the way you presented that question is big enough.
Judge?
I don't want to freak out the mayor here, but we are moving toward it. And we've already achieved it in some regard between the city and the county. And he's absolutely right. I would say it's even broader than that, a little bit broader. It's San Antonio to Georgetown. So we need to include...
Always trying to one-up.
Southern... So we need to include Southern Williamson County, which is growing rapidly. It's growing faster than Travis County. But we have achieved a species of metro government. The Texas Constitution does not allow metro government like Miami-Dade, but we have achieved it through interlocal agreements and through regional partnerships that have been of long standing. I was just making a quick list, and now I'm destroying my pen. We have a central booking interlocal. Thank you so much, Judy. We have a central booking interlocal. We have a hospital district called Central Health. We have WorkSource, which was state mandated, but it is a regional partnership. We have Integral Care, which is also a quasi-state agency, but it's a regional one. We have CAMPO, the Capital Area Metropolitan Planning Organization, for better or for worse. We, of course, have the county district and county courts of law and district courts of law at the county, which are a regional entity taking cases actually statewide. We have Austin Travis County Emergency Medical System. We have the Health and Human Services Interlocal for countywide health and human services. So through contract and through regional partnerships and regional entities, we have achieved a certain amount of metro government, but we need to keep working on it. And I wholeheartedly agree that really we're going to be looking at a barbell of Central Texas from San Antonio up to Austin, with I-35 being the connector. And we need to be thinking very deeply about how to make that partnership as robust as possible. We are, we represent a population that's larger than some small countries. Travis County alone is larger than seven states in the United States from a population standpoint.
Can we make sure the barbell doesn't reach to Dallas?
There's good folks up there.
There are great folks in Dallas.
Have y'all been following Judge Jenkins up in Dallas? He's doing awesome things. Of the six big counties, the big metro counties in the state, okay, I'm being partisan here. Sorry about that. But of the six big metros have awesome county judges. Four of them are Democrats and two of them are Republicans. And we get together once a quarter around one or the other's kitchen tables. There's great things happening in Dallas and in Tarrant County. There's great things happening in Harris County. We need to actually have partnership there, although they're never going to be like us.
I want to go to some of the engage audience questions now. And I know there's been a lot of talk this week about renters, and this is a city of renters. A lot of people can't afford to own a home here. So two of the questions kind of deal with rent. The first one, you say commercial businesses can raise rents to cover tax increase. I know that that's exactly what you said, but what does that mean for small businesses and their employees? And also, if apartment complexes raise their rents, is that going to be passed on to the people renting the apartments? Does that make sense?
Yes, okay. And we have to deal with affordability in this city because it's impacting everyone in this city. That's everyone in this city. You go anywhere in this city and everyone wants to talk about affordability, and that's true if you're in districts 1, 2, 3, 4, or you're in districts 8, 9, 10. So we need to deal with it. Not every tool that we use to address affordability will help everyone. That's not how tools work. I only wish that were the case. But we have to use all of the tools that are available to us in order to be able to address that. So a homestead exemption, which shifts the tax burden from residential property to commercial property, I think is a good thing to do for all the reasons that I've talked about. You know, I did an eminent domain practice for years. I have seen for 30-some-odd years appraisals of properties all over the city, appraisals that were done by appraisers for the government, appraisals that were done by landowners. And the one thing they have in common, because they often don't have a lot in common, the one thing they have in common is that everybody on these independent appraisers are appraising values of those properties higher than the ad valorem tax values for commercial properties. And that's not right. You know, no one likes to pay taxes, but everybody should be in favor of paying their fair share of the taxes that we do pay. And that's what this is about. But there are things that we need to do for renters. One is, when we looked, by the way, at phasing in this homestead exemption, I don't think it would be passed through to renters, but if it was, the amount of rent that would be passed to the average unit in the city, which is almost a $1,200 a month unit, was less than a dollar a month. And that's a unit that rents for almost $1,200, and I just don't believe the rent's going to go up from $1,200 to $1,250. It's just not going to happen that way. But even if it did, it's very small. The savings on the drainage fee to that same renter, rather than being just 50 cents a month, could be $4 or $5 or $6 a month. It would be 7-8 times greater than the cost if it was passed through. So we need to take a look at this holistically. It's frustrating sometimes to read the debate about this issue in the media and how it's being discussed.
A darn media.
It is. Because what we're talking about is doing something that is broader. And I think that you'll see in the conversation that we have tomorrow about the homestead exemption, also committing as a group to do something about emergency rental relief for folks that are living in apartments that now find their rents are going up and are being forced under the present situation to move and to take their kids out of schools. So we're dealing with that too, and I think it's going to be part of the conversation that happens tomorrow that we have. One tool does not fix everything. This is a city that needs to be engaged in this topic across multiple tools.
Speaking of tools to fix problems, one of the questions that came in is this one. And we've been talking about regional issues and both to our south and north. So the question is, how are we going to get rail and fix our regional mobility issues? That's how the question was framed. So, Judge Eckhart, do you want to start with it?
This is how we get rail. Y'all ready? Raise your pens. We get rail by finding a consistent, reliable funding source for it. And what I would submit to you is the consistent and reliable funding source is a source that I battled against for years, but it came anyway. I lost that fight, so I'm going to make lemonade out of what was a lemon. Toll revenues. Toll revenues. Think about it. We used to fund transportation with gas tax. The gas tax has not been raised, and automobiles are thankfully becoming more efficient with gas. So consequently, our gas revenues per capita have seriously declined. Consequently, the state of Texas went to a revenue-generating mechanism called tolls, toll roads. They were not initially implemented to manage capacity on our highways as they are used in Europe. They were implemented to gin revenue. Some worked. The CTRMA toll roads, for instance. Some didn't work so well or haven't worked so well yet, like TxDOT's 130. But it will, because the preferred growth corridor, the area where growth is coming to, is eastern Travis County. They are designed to gin tremendous amounts of revenue because they will be congestion priced. They will demand whatever the market will bear with regard to pricing structure. That means that people who simply cannot or will not get out of a single-occupant vehicle will pay a tremendous premium to get in those managed lanes. What will we use that premium for? Because it will exceed the cost to build, maintain, and operate those toll roads. We will use it to build rail and rapid bus. And I'm going to need every person in this room to help me convince the Capital Area Metropolitan Planning Organization and the Central Texas Regional Mobility Authority that that's what the toll revenue should be used for. I'm going to need every one of you to engage in that discourse, because it will take all of us to pry that additional revenue out of their hands and put it toward transit. Put toll revenue toward transit.
Mayor Adler, how do you feel about mobility and rails and tolls? And
you know, I have three thoughts. The first one is nobody likes to pay tolls. But we need revenue streams in order to be able to address mobility in the city, and that right now is the best way to do that. But it's more than just a way to raise money. It's a way to provide for transit. You know, those toll lanes that are going to be in MOPAC, in my mind, with the tolls, are going to enable those toll lanes to continue to move at 45 miles an hour or more, which means that the buses that we put in those lanes will continue to travel at high speeds. They have to travel at high speeds. If that lane becomes like any other lane we have on the road, then the buses are going to be stuck in traffic like the cars. And the only way we're going to increase transit usage is for people to be sitting in their cars and watching buses going by at 45 miles an hour. Now, not everybody's going to want to get out of their cars. There are some people who will die in their cars. I shouldn't have said it that way.
No.
The people that just will not leave their cars. But other people will. And quite frankly, if I'm one of the people who never wants to leave my car, I want as many people in my lanes to get out of their cars and get on the buses as will get out of their buses. And that's how you set that up. You know, we lost the bond election in November, and I think one of the reasons we lost the bond election in November is because people looked at that 9.5-mile segment that was downtown, and they looked at it and they said, what does that have to do with me? The votes that defeated that were not the votes that were in and around that 9.5 miles. It was all the rest of the city. I grew up in Washington, D.C. They have a great metro system there. My recollection is that when that came before the people in that city, before there was ever a selection of that first 9.5 miles, we fell in love with the regional plan. The regional plan was something that was great. And everybody saw how that plan got to them. And once everybody fell in love with that regional plan and it made sense and people wanted it, then somebody stepped forward and said, of course, you know, we can't do this all at once. We're going to start with this little 9.5-mile segment here. And we knew how much it was going to cost, and we knew how long it was going to take. And then we saw how long it was going to take to get to the other parts and what that was going to cost. And people were in favor of it because they believed it was true. And people are willing to wait for things to get to them if they really believe it's actually going to get to them. So it goes back a lot to the regional question we asked earlier. We need, in fact, a regional plan. And then I want to suggest another alternative. As we talk about the mode of transportation, we need to get the people that have always been in the room back in the room again, but we need people who have never been in that room. I was up at the University of Texas talking about something just a few weeks back, and someone from the faculty came up to me with the computer science department, came up to me and said, hey, can I talk to you about mobility and transportation? And I thought to myself, you know, 80% of the people that come up to me nowadays want to talk about transportation. So I said, sure, let's talk about transportation. He said, you know, but I don't know anything about transportation. And I thought to myself, well, that's okay, because 80% of the people that come up to me nowadays. I said, let's talk about transportation. And he said, so here's my question. It seems to me that we always keep addressing that problem as if it were a hardware problem. What would happen if we began with the premise that it's not a hardware problem, but it's a software problem? What if the conversation began there? And the answer to the software question was what drove the ultimate decision with respect to mobility and modality. You know, I thought to myself, I've never thought about it that way. At a gut level, that makes really good sense to me to think about it that way. So I turned to him and I said, "What do you mean?" And he said, "Well, you know, I don't know anything about transportation." He said, "But what if you did something like, I don't know, you took the Uber and Lyft technology and you tried to put it on steroids? What if the system that we were operating for our downtown circulator incorporated it as one aspect? You walk out of the building that you're in. You type in where you are in your app and where it is that you want to go. And that gets fed into a mainframe computer that is directing 300 six- or eight-person vans. And you look on your handheld device and a van that is relatively close to where you are, that's headed to relatively close to where it is that you want to go, gets designated to pick you up where you are, not at a bus stop or a station, pick you up where you are, where it is that you've just typed that in. And then it comes to you, and the mainframe is redirecting that computer during the course of that trip based on the number of people that are weighing in. And you can look on your handheld and see where that van is, how far it is away from you, how it's progressing to get to you. And then I thought to myself, you know, I don't know whether that works or not. I don't have a clue. But I do know that every meeting that I've been in over the years where we've been talking about a downtown circulator system, no one in the rooms I was in began a conversation that started like that. So I think that part of what we're talking about is regional, because it's going to take all of us doing it, and we need one plan, and it needs to address, and part of that plan, everybody's needs. And second, we need new voices in the room participating with us so that we don't keep rehashing the same discussion and debate over and over again.
And finally, we have a lot of bright folks in the room that are engaged. What can they do to get tackling some of the pressing community issues? And we'll wrap it up with the judge.
Oh, goodness. I mean, what you're doing right now, being at this breakfast, is part of it. I think that the issue that you wake up in the middle of the night wanting to scribble on a pad of paper about is the issue that gets you going. And for that issue, go out and find 10 other people who feel strongly about it. And then they find 10 other people. And then you find a way to communicate to the leaders who are the decision makers, or you become the decision maker yourself. Engagement is not rocket science. It simply takes putting your foot in front of your other foot over and over and over again on the issue that feeds your soul. I don't think that it's really any more complicated than that. It's the discipline to follow that burning ambition to make life better for you, for your family, for the next generation. It's simply waking up in the morning and doing the next best thing that will move us all closer to that better future. I think that one thing that I see that concerns me in our community is we stop at the intention. We state the intention and then we stop. We state what we want to happen and then we stop. As if it's enough to simply state what you want to come about. But we need to have the discipline to state it, to then come up with a vision of what it looks like to succeed, to then take the next step, and then to measure that step to see if it measures up. And that's very important, and we don't often do that. Measure it. See if the actions we took are actually achieving the goal. And if they're not, have the bravery to adjust. Have the bravery to say, that was really well-intentioned, not working so much. Let's go to the next great idea that may achieve our goal. Let's have that discipline to admit when it didn't work out, but go back to the goal. Go back to what it looks like to succeed. And that would be my prescription for myself, and I hope that I can keep reminding myself every day that the decisions I make I have to go back and take a look to see if they truly did serve the goal. It's easy to say they were well-intentioned. It's harder to say, did they work? And if they didn't, what should I do about it?
Mayor Adler, I'm glad you two are friends because you have about 45 seconds. We always promise to get people
to me
out
again,
of it.
You know?
Sorry.
Thanks, Judge. She's left me just enough time to say the judge's comments were dead on. I would also point out that, you know, we have 50 or more commissions and boards in this city, and a lot of the governance that happens in this city is done in those boards and commissions. And this council needs to refill all of those spots, and there are almost 50% more spots under this new government than there were last year, because there are 11 people making nominations, and almost half of that number of spots are unfilled as of this moment and have to be filled by the end of June. So I would say everybody here should go to that website and find something that interests you and then volunteer to be part of that. I would say that a lot of it is just discussing this stuff and then acting on it. As the judge said, it's encouraging people to vote, because after somebody votes, they become more invested and engaged. They feel a greater sense of ownership. And we need to make that part of our culture. So I would say, for every time you were with somebody, you know, ask them if they voted and start. It's early for that election, but ultimately, if we could change that number, it would change the kind of the culture in this city.
Thank you both for an engaging discussion, and we want to invite to close things out, we want to invite Geronimo Rodriguez up. He is the chairman of the board for Leadership Austin, and you can be the call to action. Send him off to get involved person, Geronimo.
Good morning, everybody. First of all, I just want to say I'm both grateful and optimistic. Grateful that each one of you got up this morning at 5 or 6 in the morning because you care about this city, you care about this county. I'm also optimistic because when our board first started talking about increasing civic engagement, we shared a study from the Annenberg School of Communications that showed that 64% of all Americans could not name the three branches of government. I want to thank you all for coming for this season. I want to thank Robert and Judy for the great work they've done today to moderating and for the season as well. You know, for over 35 years, I was 11 years old, by the way. Leadership Austin has been working to develop skills, explore issues, connect community members. And I want to thank the staff again of Leadership Austin, Christopher and all the staff, for all your leadership in putting this together. I also want to recognize our essential class again, who is here with us today. An incredible, awesome class. One 100% participation in our support of Leadership Austin. We can't be more grateful for you all. So, and thank you for all the work you did this year. We believe that the leadership changes this last year have been some of the most significant leadership shifts in our community in decades. An opportunity of a lifetime. And I want to thank Mayor Adler, County Judge Eckhart, for your open, honest, authentic conversation this morning. We can't appreciate you enough for your presence here today. Thank you.
Great discussion. Really great discussion.
You know, with these changes comes a sense of urgency to take advantage of this opportunity and champion a different way to engage all voices on our community. And I want to thank all the board members that are here today, because those board members were focusing on civic engagement, not knowing where we were going to be here and where that would lead here today. Engagement is one of our critical core values of inclusion, hearing from everybody. And though we may be a diverse community, we have some work to be an inclusive community. And we know firsthand that we have to turn the mirrors on ourselves first. And I know that in the next couple of weeks, we'll be announcing our new board of directors, which will be the most diverse by both ethnicity and industry in the history of this organization. We're very proud of that. And at the end of the month, we'll be approving a 5-year strategic plan with new attention to our alumni, community engagement, And we're going to do our best to ensure that all those programs have the voices of Austin. And last but not least, I want to thank you all for your support this year and to ask you to hold us accountable for doing our part, because we all have a stake in this community. And I can't thank you again enough for being here today. Thank you.